Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me as ever is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the podcast, we welcome Beth Thorpe to our show. She is a digital strategist. We haven't really done anybody like that on the show before, but it was really interesting. We don't talk that much about campaigns on our show, but that's one of the most important parts of politics, and digital is an increasingly important part of campaigns. So we welcomed her to talk a little bit about her work. It was a pretty good interview. I enjoyed it.
It was. I think since we don't have candidates right now, we've been interviewing a lot of cool people doing really cool stuff in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And she's one of those
people.
Yeah,
absolutely. She is worked for like nearly, I don't know, half of the campaigns.
I mean,
that
all the campaigns that won.
Yeah, she's and
a lot of judicial campaigns, metro council races.
Her track record really indicates how important her work is to some of these candidates. Either that, or she's really good at picking candidates, or maybe both. Who knows?
Probably a combination.
But before we talk to her, we are talking a little bit about Kentucky's graduation requirement story. This is something that's been ongoing for a while, but we haven't talked about it, so we're fixing that today. Jasmine's going to talk to us a little bit about Amy McGrath's potential campaign for governor and maybe a problem with that, and about Daisy Olivo's firing. So without any further ado, Jasmine, talk to us about one of those two things.
Within 24 hours of her close race with Andy Barr, people already started discussing Amy McGrath's future in politics, and she's been consistently brought up as a possible gubernatorial candidate.
Yeah, I think Josh Mers actually drafted her in our gubernatorial draft, so even before that. Yeah,
but there might be a problem. She might not be eligible. The Kentucky Constitution says that a person has to be a resident for 6 years to run for governor. Her campaign manager said it would not be an issue because Kentucky has been her primary residence since November of 2013, which would be exactly 6 years before the governor
election. When you say her campaign manager, you mean her campaign manager from her congressional race?
Yes.
Right.
Professor Josh Douglas, who was my professor in law school, he teaches civil procedure, and he's also an election law scholar. But he was interviewed in an article from the Courier Journal and said that the definition of residency would come down to her intent. You know, did she intend to remain indefinitely in Kentucky? So in the legal world, where one intends to remain indefinitely is called their domicile. And you don't lose your domicile until a new residence with intent to remain has been established. So
right.
If she established a residence in Kentucky and intended to remain there, then that's her domicile.
Right.
And so that's what this would probably come down to. And I think he compared it to Rahm Emanuel's campaign.
Mm-hmm. He was in Congress from Illinois, but he moved to D.C. to become Barack Obama's chief of staff.
Right.
Right. But he never lost his domicile in Illinois.
Yes, because he intended to return to Illinois. But there was an issue with Ernie Fletcher's lieutenant.
Hunter Pence. Who had the same deal, yeah.
Yes, and he actually ended up off the ballot because they said that wasn't his residence.
But if I remember correctly, it was something that was like being brought up as a potential issue and was never really tested in the legal system. They just kind of dropped him from the ticket. I'm pretty sure that that's right. That wasn't in the news article, but I'm pretty sure that that's what happened there. They just kind of like silent.
Right. I know that he agreed not to fight whoever made the decision
right.
that he shouldn't
right.
run.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, like, a lot of people have jobs that require them to travel, right?
Right. And certainly military service would be one of those. She has been registered to vote in Kentucky since 1995. That's one thing you might look at.
Mm-hmm.
You might also look at she voted in Kentucky elections in 2011, 2012. There's all kinds of things you look at when you're trying to determine where one's domicile is. But if she decides to run, this will be an issue from the beginning, and we won't really know until a court decides it,
right.
You know?
Yeah. And I think the bigger question is not necessarily whether or not Amy McGrath is eligible to run. I think the bigger question is whether or not she wants to
mm-hmm.
run. Yeah. And to me, she seems much better as a candidate for a legislative seat.
I think so, too.
That's not a comment on her for anything besides like what I've seen from what she seems to be interested in, which is more like being a leader on issues and talking about stuff. The nuts and bolts of running a government doesn't necessarily fit with, I don't know, kind of how I feel about her. But maybe she'll run and maybe she'll do great at it. I'm sure she would. She seems to be very talented. So, yeah, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think she would be eligible? If you were a judge, how would you rule, Jasmine?
I think she would be eligible. If it's 6 years, as Mark Nicholas said, I think she would be eligible because I think that Her military service is a traveling job. She's been registered to vote here. She's been voting here. I'd say that she established a domicile in Kentucky.
All right. Well, there you go. If you were in charge, that's where you rule. All right. Sounds good. Okay, Jasmine, I want to talk for a second about the Kentucky graduation requirements. So, Jasmine, proposed changes to Kentucky's graduation requirements have been a big story for several months, if you've been paying attention to the news. But we, here on My Old Kentucky Podcast, have neglected the story, and we're fixing that now. So at the end of September, which is, you know, several months ago at this point, new data confirmed an old problem. Many Kentucky high school graduates were not getting much of an education and were not able to transition away from school successfully. Because of this, or maybe using this as a smokescreen, Kentucky Education Commissioner Wayne Lewis, who we've talked about multiple times before, he proposed changing graduation requirements in Kentucky in some major ways. Chiefly among them, and this is the most controversial, is that there would be a test in the 10th grade to prove educational progress. Algebra 2 would no longer be a required course, and students would have to demonstrate college or career readiness. In kind of a complicated way, which I'm not really sure how that would have worked.
What does he have against Algebra 2?
That's a good question.
Algebra 2 seems pretty important for STEM fields, I would think.
Yeah, and that's something that the governor has decided is the most important thing in the entire world. Jasmine, speaking as a data scientist, like that's my day job, I do think that we overemphasize things like calculus and algebra and underemphasize statistics.
Yes.
I think we need more statistics and less algebra. But that's just me. I'm not a math teacher. So that's just my opinion.
I definitely didn't take calculus,
yeah.
And I don't feel like I missed out.
No. But I do think, you know, math is important, but I think dropping Algebra 2 without adding a different math in is maybe not the best idea. But anyways, I also don't know much about how curriculum works, and I haven't really studied the efficacy of one versus the other. I'm just talking about what other people have said. Okay, upon seeing the proposals of Wayne Lewis, many education groups across the state told the Kentucky School Board to slow down and make sure to get everything exactly right before voting to change everything. There was clearly some concern on the part of the education community around all these proposals, even though nearly everyone said that the policy change was necessary. I mean, everybody was basically in agreement that we need to strengthen our, you know, graduation requirements because we're graduating too many people that don't know anything, but we needed to make sure that we got it right. The school board, though, continued undeterred. In early October, a week after the proposals became public knowledge, the school board voted unanimously to accept the proposals and put them in place in the 2020-2021 school year. So about this, one of the groups that called for more discussion to say to slow down was the Pritchard Committee. And if you haven't heard of the Pritchard Committee, they're one of the most significant groups dealing with education policy in the entire state of Kentucky. Commissioner Lewis said that the Pritchard Committee intentionally misled, those are his words, he said they intentionally misled the public about the exit exam portion of the proposal. So there was some very heated rhetoric there. The Pritchard Committee pointed out several pieces of research that called into question the efficacy of these types of high-stakes tests, and then further clarified their questions after being called out by Lewis. Jasmine, there is plenty of evidence that high-stakes testing does not help improve graduates' prospects.
Absolutely.
But what Lewis pointed out is that the proposal that he came up with also included an option to demonstrate competency through portfolio work, which he said was less high-stakes. Maybe you're not like locked in a room, but to me it still feels pretty high-stakes. Like, do well on this paper that you're writing versus do well on this test that you have to take. I mean, maybe it's just anxiety spread out over a longer period of time, which may or may not be any better. The vote by the school board that they took, that triggered a 30-day comment period, and that wrapped up at the end of November. So lots of people across the state filed comments and then met on November 29th, last month, for a public comment meeting. According to media reports, all but one commenter was opposed to the changes that Lewis wanted to make, which isn't uncommon. Like, whenever you have a big controversial change, people who are like, yeah, sounds good to me, typically don't show up, and the people who are like
right.
intensely
it's
opposed.
It's like restaurant reviews. The people that had a good experience usually
yeah.
don't review them, but it's the bad ones that go online and say how angry they
well,
are.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you ever watched like Parks and Recreation. Actually, I know you have. So,
yeah.
Like that's the joke there is like people just show up to express disapproval and not necessarily to do anything about, to say, oh, you know, that seems like a good plan to me. But anyways, right. This week on December the 3rd, Wayne Lewis stated that the proposals would take what he called a step back. So this is a quote from him. We received constructive feedback from stakeholders across the state and have consistently made revisions to the proposal that we hope will result in a high school diploma that meets the needs of all Kentucky students in the future workforce of the Commonwealth, unquote. So, you know, he basically is like, hey, you know what, we need to take a step back. The stuff that these people said did make some sense. So he came up with a new proposal, and he said that the new proposal would extend the exam portion of the proposal to include the 10th grade exam or the state-based assessment that they also have to take, or what's called a student collection of evidence that they are competent, which could include transcripts and test scores, unquote. So basically the high-stakes test, there's now two of them. There's now two high-stakes tests, and if you already had to take both, but if you did well enough on either of them, you would pass. And then if you didn't do well on either of those things, now there's a collection of evidence that you can present if you like do really bad on tests or whatever to show that you're good enough to graduate. And the collection of evidence is a set of like six items. They laid this out. And the six items would need to be collected by the students. There isn't any information I can see about who is like actually auditing or examining this documentation. So basically it's like, here's my documentation.
I pass now?
Yeah. And who's looking at it and is like, yeah, that looks good to me. Like, is the state school board doing this? Like, if, you know, if there's one guy in like that goes to Central High School in Louisville and then somebody that goes to Paintsville High School, do they just send their stuff to the same place or do they send it to their own individual school boards? Like, how does that work? There wasn't really much detail that I could see around that. Additionally, the transition readiness portion, this like college and career readiness portion, has been scrapped in favor of a set of seven graduation qualifiers. If a student possesses at least one of the seven, they will qualify for graduation. So the reason they did this is because they said that in order to promote equality for rural districts, which have fewer opportunities to demonstrate career readiness, they needed something other than like shadowing at like a career, like a place where you have a career or taking an AP class. Like some of these things just aren't available in some of these rural school districts that don't have a lot of money and don't have a very big tax base. So they needed a different way to do it. The list of the actual seven items is available in the Courier Journal. That was a story from 12/3 where they listed it, and that article is by Mandy McLaren. So, yeah, like taking an AP class and passing it and getting at least a three, I think, proves college readiness is what the idea is there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do some like shadowing at like a factory or see what work is like, I think, is another one. And then there's like several others that you can do. And if you do like one of these seven things, you're good to go. Okay, so this new proposal needs to be approved, and the Pritchard Committee still is asking the school board to slow down before making changes, saying that getting these issues right is really important. And I think their big issue is not that they are opposed to changes, it's that they think that we really need to get this right because there could be unintended consequences, and causing other problems is not good.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. There doesn't seem to be any doubt that Kentucky's graduation requirements are broken and need fixing. The main disagreement is over how to go about determining how to fix the problem. The speed at which Lewis is moving could absolutely cause unexpected consequences, but there doesn't seem to be anybody stopping him. So it doesn't seem like there's any barriers to getting this done. And at the same time, like moving quickly is something that, you know, people often want. So, you know, they're going to get it, I guess.
All right.
There you go. Jasmine, tell us all about Daisy Olivo.
All right. So this is kind of more like an extended quick hit because there's not a lot of information out about this story yet. But you've heard Daisy Olivo's name when we've talked about the Jeff Hoover sexual harassment allegations.
Right.
Miss Olivo filed a whistleblower lawsuit claiming that she was retaliated against for reporting the sexual harassment complaint. So she was the communications director for the House Republicans, and she said that she'd basically been put on paid suspension since reporting the allegations.
Right.
But now the new Republican leadership has terminated her.
So she's officially no longer employed there at all.
Right. Her attorney said that she was not given a reason for the dismissal. Security just showed up and walked her out on Friday afternoon. And we're still waiting on a ruling right now regarding whether the depositions will be sealed or redacted in her whistleblower lawsuit.
Right.
But I'm sure that actually getting terminated might help her whistleblower lawsuit,
yeah.
I would think.
Yeah, you'd think, right?
Maybe some amended pleadings.
I don't know. You're a lawyer. She's an at-will employee, and they basically don't have to provide any documentation for a reason for firing her. Like, would that bolster her?
Well, it's not really... It's a whistleblower suit, not a wrongful termination suit, but I would certainly think it would help her cause.
Right,
you
that
know?
Makes sense, yeah.
But, you know, we don't know why she was fired, but she's out and we don't really have any rulings in her lawsuit yet. So that's kind of all we know.
Right. Well, yeah, she's going to be she is a key figure, has been a key figure, and it seems like she's likely to continue to be a key figure in this whole rigmarole. Okay, a couple of quick hits before we move on to our interview with Beth. DJ Johnson, who is the Owensboro Republican who lost by a single vote in his state house race, he is going to file a recount petition. He's also calling for the legislature, which maybe will include him, to change the recount process. And actually, after I read about this, it makes a lot of sense to me. So currently, the legislature itself is in charge of conducting recounts, and it requires the approval of the leadership in the chamber in question before a recount can be done. So basically, like the House itself has to approve a recount if they feel like one is necessary. And with the increasing partisan nature,
right.
It seems like, you know, having these things automatically triggered and run by the State Board of Elections would be a more appropriate...
Rather than the Republicans determining whether or not a Democrat can get a recount.
Of course. Yeah, exactly.
Or vice versa.
And there's rules around, like, who has to be on the Board of Elections. Like, you have to have a certain number of Republicans, you have to have a certain number of Democrats. And so that actually is a change that makes sense to me. So, DJ Johnson, I hope you get your reform passed. So there you go. All right, one other quick thing. The GOP caucus in the Senate released its leadership a few weeks ago, and we talked about that. And this week we know of the GOP's leadership in the House, and there have indeed been some changes. So David Osborne, who had been like the acting Speaker of the House, is now just Speaker of the House. The acting title is washed away, and now he's officially got the big job. Taking his old job of Speaker pro tempore will be David Meade, who represents the 80th District in Lincoln and Pulaski counties, kind of in southeastern Kentucky. Representative Meade had previously been the caucus chair, but he actually moved up two spots because now David Osborne is the Speaker and Jonathan Schell lost re-election. So he's actually moved up two spots to the Speaker pro tem spot. Bam Carney of Campbellsville, he was the main House legislator working to pass pension reform in the last session. There's lots of stories about him like being very anxious about the whole situation. He is now the majority floor leader. That's Representative Schell's previous job. So it seems like he's being rewarded for his work on that issue. Suzanne Miles of Owensboro is the majority caucus chair, which is Representative Meade's old job. And Chad McCoy of Bardstown is the majority whip. So Chad McCoy is taking over for Kevin Bratcher, who stepped down for leadership. And he's in a little bit more of a dangerous seat now than I think he has been in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe one of the reasons they wanted to do that. And also, Representative Bratcher said he accomplished all the things he wanted to do. So whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, and they do have a woman. Suzanne Miles is now the second woman in leadership for the next session. There were none the past 2 years, and now the Republicans have put two women in leadership, one in each chamber. So there you go. All right, Jasmine, with that, let us get to our interview with Beth Thorpe. Beth Thorpe is an independent digital strategist who works for Democratic campaigns. Beth started as a super volunteer and eventually became the digital director for Representative Mackenzie Cantrell's initial campaign for the Kentucky House. She then transitioned to working independently for multiple campaigns. During the 2018 campaign, Ms. Thorpe worked for several campaigns in Louisville and across the state, including Maria Sorales, Tina Bojanowski, Sherilyn Stevenson, Annie O'Connell, Danny Alvarez, and she managed the Jefferson County Democratic Party's digital coordinated campaign. Beth Thorpe, welcome to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I usually get introduced as Beth, the girl that does Facebook. So what an introduction.
I have also heard you introduced as Beth Superwoman. So we weren't quite that serious. So yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you know, and you've given all these lists of all these people I did. I right at the top, I want to give a little bit of credit to someone who doesn't get the credit, which is Megan Wright, who worked with me.
Okay.
In this campaign, she was my right-hand gal. I would not been I worked on, I think, 15 campaigns.
Wow.
Would not have been able to do it without her. So she did all the like the graphic stuff and worked with candidates a lot, and I did strategy and advertising and digital. So I just was like, right off the top, I want to say, Megan, I could not have done it without you.
Cool.
Hopefully Megan's listening.
I'm going to make sure Megan listens to this.
All right. So digital campaigning is something that sounds extremely fancy, but it's also very mysterious. So in your words, what exactly is digital campaigning?
You know, I've never really heard it called digital campaigning before. When I hear the terms digital campaigning, I think like it's an equivalent to like digital knocking on doors.
Right.
But digital's big is the thing. It's hard to, I mean, it's everything. Mm-hmm. It's in all areas of campaigns. It's also recommended that your digital person in your campaign is sort of at the top level mm-hmm. of a campaign because it's so embedded literally in everything. I mean, it's like it's your communications, both external to the world and internal in the campaign. Like, where do we keep those documents? Right. How are we communicating? It's your advertising, your digital advertising, your banner ads, addressable TV, pre-roll video. It's targeting data, social media. A lot of times managing creative, you know, videos, graphics, all those sort of things. Your texting programs, do you get texted by someone to go vote? That's digital. Your email program, you know, websites. Literally, when digital's done well, it's hand in glove with every other aspect of your campaign, right. field, all of it.
And so I think I know the answer to this question, but does every campaign need a digital strategy?
Yes, if you want to win.
If you want to win, there you go.
I mean, honestly, I'll say I think some better digital strategies in some races in Kentucky this year would have meant we had more wins. There was a few that, I mean, there's just not, not everybody is thinking this is necessary, but I think we could have won more this year.
Mm-hmm. And who can run a digital campaign? Can just anyone do it?
No, but it's a qualified no. You really do need some training to do it well. But that doesn't mean that people need to be able to do everything that I talked about above. You just did, especially here in Kentucky where there's so much need on campaigns. So don't discount being like a big self-learner. I did that a lot, especially in my first one. Google is our friend. But training makes a huge difference. It really does. And what just knowing who to talk to, what to do, strategies, because it can be overwhelming.
Right.
Just as a follow-up to that, what kind of training is there? Like, who do you go to? Learn this kind of stuff?
You know, because it's so big, it depends. I mean, there's a certain amount of talking to vendors and them show you their stuff. There's knowing which digital companies to work with for advertising. There's also, I mean, I went to Wellstone for a couple different trainings, but they're now called Repower. They just rebranded this last weekend at Roots Camp.
I guess he's been dead too long for anybody to remember.
You know, that's a big old story why they did. But you know what? They're still a really great organization. Yeah. I loved Paul Wellstone, so it was a little painful. But I think it's actually going to work really well for them.
Right.
But I did digital organizing school there and data and analytics with them. But that was a start. But that really made it go more. You know, what else did I need?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said that you feel like we could have had more wins if more people had a digital strategy. So what are some excuses that you've heard for why campaigns are not investing in digital?
Oh, excuses. Okay. I've heard not everyone has Facebook or Instagram or has a computer. I've also heard we need money for the mail or we need money for TV. Mm-hmm. That's the other ones. Not excuses, but reasons. Mm-hmm. The consultant's not making money on digital, therefore the campaign's not using it.
Right.
Or not the candidate possibly not understanding it themselves or uses it themselves, like social media or anything. So it feels very foreign, and so it's just unknown. And then the other on digital, this is especially not so much in social media, but in digital targeting, it doesn't feel like anything's happening. There's no buzz. It's just targeting the people it's supposed to target. It feels like nothing is going on.
Interesting.
You know, so especially like a lot of times we don't target the best voters. We target the people that don't vote as often.
Right.
So the people always in campaigns vote every single time. So they're like, I haven't seen anything. And none of my friends, because all of your friends vote all the time.
Right. And they're already going to vote for. Yeah, that's exactly
right. Yeah.
Well, I think that's actually really one of the points there that caught my attention was this, the consultants, which is a thing I've heard a lot. Like the consulting class is stuck in the direct mail mode, and moving beyond that's been kind of a struggle across the country. Do you think that that's true in Kentucky as well?
Yes. I think one of the things is that's what's happened is I'm not ever saying you don't do mail because you have to do mail. I mean, honestly, my real love is winning elections. I have sometimes said, even though I'm the digital person, I have said you need to handwrite a thank you note to that. It has to be from the candidate. Uh-huh. So, I mean, all these are strategies around messaging. But yes, I think that, I mean, people make money on mail. Mm-hmm. They do. You know?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, consultants themselves, and that's kind
of, they make a percentage off the top. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I mean, and that's not saying that that's wrong. It's just when you are how you make your money, mm-hmm. if you don't make your money on a thing,
right.
That feels very scary to recommend that. Although, you know, I was able, for the digital coordinated for the county, I was able to go back to the executive committee and do a report. And I was able to say that we, for 5.5 cents, we were, per person, we were able to do outreach to them.
Wow.
And that was almost 90,000 people.
That's less than a stamp, that's for sure.
It's way less than a stamp, you know? And so multiple layers of engagement are essential.
Well, you work mostly for Democratic campaigns. A lot of nonpartisan races, too, of course, for judge and everything else. But, you know, given the class of digital strategists in Kentucky, is there a difference between the parties when it comes to investing in digital technology? Like, are Republicans more likely to do it? Are Democrats more likely to do it? Is there a difference?
Yeah. Yeah, I want to just be clear. I really only do work on Democratic campaigns and nonpartisan, and if they are nonpartisan, they are a Democrat. If I lived in Seattle still, I would work farther left party, but where someone could actually win.
Right.
But that's not in Kentucky. I'm a Democrat. I work for Democrats. But there is across the board, I think there's some misunderstanding on, I think there's this idea Republicans are stodgy and they don't do digital and they're not smart that way. And that maybe used to be. They are incredibly smart. They invest 40% of their budgets in digital, of much bigger budgets in digital. And we are way behind on the Democratic side. And honestly, I mean, I was just reading about this before coming here, that not only is there less money, but there's just less people that to actually do the work.
Right.
Especially on the Democratic side.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard, and this is apocryphal, that's why we have you on here to clear this stuff up for us, but like the Obama campaign did so well with digital that, you know, Democrats were like, well, we crushed the Republicans, I guess we're done here, and Republicans really worked very hard and were able to kind of come back and didn't have a centralized force to do that with, so a lot of different kinds of Republicans are doing really well, whereas Democrats just have a few large firms that they're working with that do most of the work. Is that the case, or...?
You know, there's more companies. I mean, I think it depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about, like, I'm a digital strategist, I work on a campaign. And then there are firms that, unless you're very, very big, all you're doing is buying ads from them.
Right.
I mean, Kamala Harris has the best, in my opinion, one of the best digital firms ever working for her.
Right.
And,
That's key if you want to run for president, for sure.
And so. Yes, and if anyone wonders if she's running for president, she would not be doing the kind of social media testing that she's doing.
Yeah.
That would be stupid
there
on her
clues,
part. She's
yes.
not stupid.
Yeah.
All right. So before you started working on Representative Cantrell's campaign, you had not been working in politics full time. So tell us a little bit how you ended up doing this job.
I had done a bunch of a lot of social media with some nonprofit groups that like I was like on their board and things like that. And I live in the South End. I live in Representative Cantrell's district. And at the time, it was, you know, a contested seat. Danny Butler had flipped. I was really pissed off about that. You know, and then, so therefore, there was going to be a Democratic primary.
Oof.
I did not know. I had been introduced to McKenzie, and I found her really interesting. I thought it would be a really great shakeup to have someone under 30 elected. She was one of those go-getters who, like, always knew she wanted to be an attorney. And so I talked to her, and we had a meeting, and I said, let me help you with your social media. I could tell she was doing it all by herself.
Right.
And you really can't. That's one of the things. You really need someone else. When you're knocking on doors that much, you can't do it. So I worked in the primary with her. We won. She won in almost every precinct heavily. And then we knew we had big stuff. And I said, you know, I'll help you with this. And I ended up becoming her digital director. I learned a lot very, very fast on the fly to learn how to do things for candidates. I learned a lot more after, too. I'm really lucky. I have had a lot of advertising, marketing. My husband's a creative director. I'm just kind of soaked in that kind of world. So I feel like I had a little head up. So... I think it's already a long story. But we beat the Koch brothers. I was really planning on that kind of just being a one and done. I was like, I just want to help her. This will be great. She's my rep. And then we got Trump, and we lost the state house here, and we beat the Koch brothers. And once you beat the Koch brothers one time, y'all, you want to do it over and over and over and over and over again. Because it's possible.
Right.
I realized it was possible. And that's the one thing I say to people. I don't think we're trying hard enough. We can be possible. So yeah. And then I did a bunch of schooling after to shore up. And, you know, and I had some good instincts in what I was doing, I realized.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you had an innate talent for it. And you like you said, you beat the Koch brothers, and then also you recognize.
Well, McKenzie beat. I'm going to be clear. It never happens without a great candidate.
Y'all beat the Koch brothers.
Tech does not beat the Koch brothers. There was a whole team that did it, but I was part of it, and it was pretty exciting.
And I think you recognize the need for this sort of stuff across the state. Yeah, and that's a nice confluence, right? When you find out the thing that you're good at.
Yeah.
Like, and just in case there's people who are, you know, friends of the pod that maybe weren't paying attention in the 2016 primary, McKenzie ran against Dan Johnson, who we've talked about on this podcast lots of times. So that was a real exciting primary. I'm sad we didn't have the podcast to talk about it, so.
That would have been a fun podcast to do.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, here we are. We know. Here's the other part. No one named Dan Johnson should ever go into Kentucky politics ever again. You've got to change your name.
If you're a really cool progressive dude named Dan Johnson, I'm sorry. It's just not going to work
change
out for you.
Change it up. Just go do it now.
Okay. So I've heard more than one Democratic politician in Kentucky describe you as superwoman, like I said at the beginning of the show. you're one of the only people doing this work. Like, that's one of the things that I come back to a lot is, you know, this is, there's a huge need for this. Like you said, everybody, if you want to win, you have to have this. And there's not that many people doing this type of work in the state. So if someone else wanted to get started doing this, you know, what advice would you give to them?
Superwoman's kind of almost scary, you know?
Maybe that's something you want, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's overwhelming. I keep hoping that I'm wrong, that there's some other people that are actually focusing on Kentucky. I mean, there's people that are doing some digital buying and stuff, but like actually embedded in campaigns, running real strong, is especially social media. That's not so much happening. But anyway, I have something I can't talk about yet, actually. I know. I'm sorry I'm on your podcast. But hopefully there's going to be an announcement in the next month. Getting people trained is a very big deal to me. I mean, I can say this. It would be folks for wanting to learn to do digital in Kentucky.
Right.
This is not for someone to go off to Washington, D.C. The details are still being worked out. I'm looking to develop people all across the state.
Great.
I mean, so I can't really go into big specifics, but that's my goal. Mm-hmm. But what exactly it's looking like is still being worked on and who it's with.
Well, I mean, and that actually makes me think of another question, which is a little bit like, you know, as digital kind of explodes in terms of a campaign technology and everybody kind of comes to the realization that they're going to need this.
Yeah.
There will be people that step up to do the work, but they may be from out of state. So how important, I mean, you mentioned you wanted to work with people in Kentucky. How important has your knowledge of Kentucky politics and just kind of the fact that you live here helped you to serve campaigns in Kentucky?
I think messaging people, I think occasionally people out of the area can really message. And those are very, very talented and very expensive people because they're very, very good. I think one of the reasons that I was most effective for McKenzie is that was my district.
Right.
I knew every type of person. I knew who they were. Because, you know, they think digital, and you think, oh, you're techie here on the computer, you do these tech things, and it's like, really, it's. I mean, I consider myself truly, I know I call myself a digital strategist, that's more of a campaign term, but I really consider myself a digital organizer, and, you know, that's what this really is, and if you're really going to be effective in campaigns, especially the farther you get away from definitely Democratic districts, you have to know the people.
Right.
So I actually, my theory of change is that the people who are doing messaging are as close as possible. And I think it makes a big difference, especially where it's a tricksy, like until you know those dudes that have coffee at McDonald's every morning and what they're worried about.
Right. Well, not you just know? That. I think a lot of times, you know, McKenzie's district's incredibly diverse.
Very. In every possible way.
Right. And one of the things is I think a lot of the voters in that district got overlooked because they just weren't on anybody's radar for the longest time.
I will call out the Somali community now.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
The Somali community was incredibly supportive for McKenzie. They continue to be. They are incredible Democrats. Yeah. I love them. I mean, Idris Ali, the head of the Somali youth, actually did a video in the campaign that I did for Louisville Democrats this year of asking how important that midterms were and to go vote for, you know, Congressman Yarmouth, go vote for the mayor, go vote for your state reps. He even recommended certain judges.
Uh-huh.
And it was really important, you know, that we did that.
Mm-hmm. So switching gears a little bit, data and ethics are both very hot topics. Tell us how you think through the ethical use of data in the midst of doing your work. Is there maybe anything you decided not to do because of ethical concerns?
what a massive subject.
Right.
And I mean, it's true. And I think there's ethical issues on this really grand scale with these privately owned platforms that we all use every day, which is relatively new. Mm-hmm. I mean, besides phones that we ever did before, but we've decided that we, you know, these companies do this. So there's their ethical problems, and they've got a lot. But there's always ethical considerations in data, how it's collected. In 2016, I mean, it was really interesting being someone that worked extensively on the Facebook ad platform. You could drive a fleet of Mack trucks through the loopholes. And I would not have been a very good digital director if I did not occasionally think about I could do that too.
Right.
Because this is what Trump did. I mean, Trump's campaign, they built separate, completely separate Facebook pages that looked like union members had them, or it was like some sort of Black Lives Matter, possibly, or, you know, all these different, you know, different constituencies, you know, that they, you know, that they believed in. And then you could use any ad account to advertise on any Facebook page. So if you're unethical, what do? You pretend you're people you're not. It's one massive catfish. And, you know, I would not have been that great of a digital person if I wouldn't have occasionally thought about, you know, to make a page against her opponent and pay for it.
Right.
You know,
right.
I did not do that. Let me be very clear. But I was like, but it would be possible, you know. I mean, so no. I mean, I think ethics are really important. And I think ethics should be taught.
Right.
With digital, I mean, think about that guy with data, with Cambridge Analytica.
Right.
Who ended up being the whistleblower. A lot of data and in tech people, we think about that it's figuring out a problem. There's this thing to figure out. This is really cool. You work in data, Robert. You know?
I do, yes.
And so you know, you're like, oh, this is this thing. And you could see it in his mind. He wasn't very old. Mm-hmm. And he got offered all this money to do this really cool thing. And then it wasn't realized it was over how it was used. And
right.
So I think ethics training could be used up and down tech.
Well, and I mean, I think one of the things that really people struggle with, especially people who want to do good things for their community by like running for office or whatever, like, you know, they want to do the right thing. And this is one of the big scary things is that there are so many like unethical things you can do on these platforms. And having somebody on their team who is able to make good ethical decisions about this sort of stuff is really important. And that's why investing in a good digital strategist is a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as easy. I will say it's not as easy anymore.
Right.
But I think there's always, you know, who you target and why.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think that could also get into
sure.
strategy of the campaign itself. Why are you targeting this person for this
right.
reason? Are you targeting everyone you should?
Right.
I actually, I target a lot of people. I will just to say they're... you can target, for much less money, people that are usually not considered worth talking to that I think we should all be talking to more. Maybe we would win more races.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, while we're talking about these digital platforms, you know, that you mentioned, I think that's a really interesting topic for your work. So those technology and digital platforms are always changing. You
yeah.
mentioned, like, you know, you used to be able to drive a Mack truck through these Facebook portals, and obviously Facebook has worked to change some of that, right?
Oh, Facebook likes to change, like, at the worst possible times.
Yeah.
I hate them.
Exactly. But, I mean, and this is one of the big issues, right? You're kind of dependent on a lot of these platforms,
yes.
and they're always changing. And so how do you do that? How do you stay on top of the shifts that these platforms have? And what do you think are changes that you might have to stay on top of as these things continue to evolve?
Well, you never really know. I mean, the biggest thing was the political verification they made everyone do on almost every platform now. And they all have a completely different process. It's helpful. But as far as like staying on top of it, I read a lot every day. Every day. And it'll be like, oh, this is happening now? It's happening 3 days before the primary?
Right.
Oh, my God. Okay. I mean, there was both before the primary and the general, there were things like that. And it actually made me think that people made it harder for regular people in campaigns to do this stuff. But I read, I follow a lot of very in-the-know people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's you know, there's various social media today I keep up with. I mean, I think some other things will have to happen is changes into the future. I think campaigns are going to really need to accept that they need to do Instagram and actually have people embedded in their campaign that actually like taking pictures. I mean, I would actually say that in general, that campaigns need to get used to the idea they create their own media,
yeah.
that's just as important as everything
yeah.
else.
Well, I mean, just, you know, national politics for a second, but like the what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has done with
her. She's great.
Yeah, I mean,
she's great.
Whatever you think about her, like politically or whether you support her or whatever, the way that she's been able to use social media has kind of set a new paradigm, I think. And people are going to have to start thinking about making their own mac and cheese in front of.
Well, and I mean, I think you need to be authentic to yourself. Right. And I think one of the things about her is everything she did was very authentic to herself. She even wrote her own ad. She wrote the ad, everything she said. And so I think that's why it was so authentic.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I think people discount a lot how much that helped Donald Trump when he ran for president.
Yes, like he was exactly who he was.
Yeah, exactly.
And
people value that, I think.
You know, when you look at metrics on videos that get put up, honestly, stuff that looks like a TV commercial does not do as well on digital as just it looks like someone kind of walking around their place. Now, both are scripted incredibly.
Exactly.
You still
exactly.
script these things. You right. still, you know, but people sitting at their dining room table actually goes over pretty well.
Absolutely.
A lot of the time.
We're in like the Blair Witch era of social media maybe where like it looks like it's real, but it's actually totally fake. And, you know, we're going to have to, everybody's going to
figure
that out.
It's been that way for a while, honestly, if you've done it right.
Yeah,
but yes.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
I do not believe in the Blair Witch way of like you, it's bumpy all over the place. That's.
Oh, no, not that. No,
yeah, that's horrible.
Not, no, yeah.
I will add one other thing to your tech. Things changing all the time. I was at Roots Camp this weekend, and I was in a panel with all of the digital directors, DNC, DLCC, and I talked to the DLCC guy, and I said, "What do you think's the next thing?" And blah blah blah. And he said, he looked at me, you know, and because I wanted to know what was he thought was the next platform, and he was like, "You know, our biggest issue are bad consultants selling digital that don't know what they're doing."
Right.
And I was like, "Okay." It's like that's really our biggest issue. Don't worry about any of the platforms. And I'm like, "Alrighty then."
Yeah. Right.
All right. Is there anything else that we've missed about digital strategy or the campaigns you've worked on or anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
Yes, of course I do. You know, of course I've got more stuff to say. I would like to say here as someone who's a partisan consultant, using digital platforms that work both sides of the aisle is a big old no for me. I don't think we should be using them. Why would we ever want to give money to companies that have our data and work the other side of the aisle? And like Nation Builder is a huge one for me. It's a great constituent relationship manager. It's where you put all your information in about your candidates, who gives money to you, or your voters. But they're Donald Trump's CRM.
Right.
Why would we ever do that? So anyway, all of those, I think that's really important on digital platforms. They have your data. I will plug Action Network right now as my favorite CRM that's Progressive owned, and it's cheap. The other is how important authentic creative is to the work. And we just kind of talked about that.
Right.
You know, it's like you really need to be you, especially on social media. It can't be canned. And then the other is we're on a podcast. May I swear?
I'll bleep it out. But
Robert's bleeped me before.
Robert bleeped out. OK.
We get the family tag. Yeah.
All right. Oh, we get the family tag. OK. So I can't really say it without it. But people really get this tech loving idea. And one of the things I say in some of my trainings is that digital isn't if you don't connect with people. And really all this is messaging to people and talking to people and creating a relationship between the candidate and the voter and the community. And so fancy things, techie tools, are not as important as communicating for real with people.
Right. You know? I mean, that's what it all comes down to.
And that's my digital organizer part. It's really about connection.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and when you think about it, like that's what direct mail was back in the day. That's what yard signs are about. You know, that's all of it's about connecting with people.
Right. It's about connecting with people. And it's just, and I think there's this kind of this tech magic. And I think there's a lot of out there in the digital world. A lot of people, there's an ethical thing too about not taking advantage of people with tech magic. Be like, because, you know, if I want to, I could just make it all sound real fancy.
Right.
But it's really about just talking to people.
Right. I mean, all of your campaign strategy should be an amplification of the messages you want to send in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that, I think that point about data is so important, right? I mean, not just with, you know, your digital campaigns, but just people listening. Like, don't give your data to people that you don't want to have it.
Because they're going to have your data.
Yeah.
They will have your data. And you can say, oh, there's a firewall, there's whatever. One idiot in a company.
And
they give it.
And even then, like,
why give them money?
Yeah, they lie all the time. Like,
right.
Yeah, I've seen it. It happens.
Yes, I have too. So yeah. I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm not playing here.
But just lastly, you know, if there are aspiring campaigns or aspiring digital strategists or just general fans of Beth Thorpe, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
You know, I'm a terrible digital person as far as like websites and all that for myself. I have no dog and pony show. I'm pretty on that end. I'm pretty low key. I guess I need to have it now. I'm going to have to do that when I'm not.
No,
doing
don't
other
do
things.
It. Just like continue to exist on word of mouth that you can be like, oh, this mysterious Beth Thorpe. Like, if you really want to win, talk to Beth.
I'm
going to
do the thing that's really scary. Here's my email address. You really want to know about trainings or if you're a campaign in Kentucky. I do not work anywhere else, y'all. I can't imagine. But it's bethann.thorpe@gmail.com. You feel free to email me.
Awesome. Great.
And it's an and without an E.
All right. Well, email Beth if you want. And I mean, if you get in contact with us, we'll put you in touch with her. So it's cool. Yeah. Well, Beth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it being here. This is great.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @MyOldKYPod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. You can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. We also have a newsletter that you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldKentuckyNewsletter. And we also have a Patreon page where you can sponsor us for as little as $1 a month. That's at patreon.com/myoldKentuckyPodcast. And finally, we are also a part of the Forward Kentucky Network, so you can find our podcast and our newsletter on forwardky.com.
Right, yeah. There's some good stuff on that website right now. They have a thing about some pre-filed legislation by Kelly Flood about sexual misconduct in the legislature. That's a big story that happened that we didn't talk about today. And also they talked a little bit about the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce and their big event, which actually is where a lot of the news that we talked about today came from. There's a lot of stuff that happened there, and they had a little write-up about that too. So, all right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.